All nurses to the nurses station.
Lawless country people, all real close family. Lately, some of my kinfolk don't get around too good, you see. When that doctor asked them, "Son, how'd you get in this condition?" They says, "Hey, sawbones, I'm just carrying on an old family tradition." Wanna know, Doc, why do you think I got some pain in my joints? He is playing hard in this life that's too short. When that doctor asked me, "Son, how'd you get in this condition?" I says, "Hey, sawbones, I'm just carrying on it all." Tell me all about it, Doc.
Hey, everybody. Dr. Ryan Sawbones Molly here, and welcome to Hey Sawbones, My Story, My Passion. Tonight's guest, it's a childhood friend, literally grew up just around the corner, and where myself grew up and my guest, there aren't a lot of corners and there aren't a lot of neighbors. So you know this. You've seen this episode 1,000 times with other people from the area being these local celebrities. But this one, I mean, she's hit it big time. She's done so many really, really big things, personally, professionally. Really excited about this one. We've had to reschedule a couple times, but without further ado, Tiffany Beers.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Ryan. This is so crazy to me that we are chatting on a podcast right now.
Where are you at right now, by the way?
I'm in Boston, outside of Boston.
Awesome. I love Boston, by the way.
It's great. I like it so far.
Just chatting before you got on with Jay. I don't know if you follow Boston sports at all, but did you see Jason Tatum's injury last night?
No, I didn't see it, but...
Yeah, devastating. I was watching the game, and so my oldest son, Anthony, he's a huge Celtics fan. Youngest son, Luca, he's a huge Knicks fan. So they're, you know, going at it, and... For all those viewers out there that may have seen it, may not have, but Jason Tatum, he tore his Achilles last night. It was devastating. So I think he's already had surgery, actually, from what I was reading.
Really? That's fast.
Very fast.
Yeah.
That's cool. So, but I mean, you literally just grew up just around the curve on 408. We used to go to church together for Sunday school, and I think Uncle Joe would bring us over there. My Uncle Joe from down in Townville, but... You've been busy over the past several decades.
Yeah, so have you. It's crazy to think. I was thinking about this podcast, and I was thinking crawfish. Remember, we would hunt crawfish in the woods.
So it's so funny you bring that up, because I don't know if you'd heard, but I bought their property. You remember Mrs. Drake's old property?
Mrs. Drake.
She had the pond. Yeah. Used to decorate it for Christmas, Halloween, all those things. So I bought that property. There's 52 acres there. It goes way back into the woods. And we bought it about a year and a half ago. And we were just there this past weekend. And my boys were like, you know, "Hey, let's go play in the creek." I'm like, "Yeah, well, you know, you can hunt for crawfish out there." And they're like, "What?" I'm like, "Yeah, you know, you lift it." I was telling them how to do it. And they were catching tadpoles in the pond. So we had a great time. So city boys... learning to live in the country a little bit.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
Yeah. So I know that you mentioned you had seen a little bit of Ryan Ray's episode, but the way that this works, you know, I'd like to kind of first start off by first and foremost introducing you, but then having you kind of give a 30,000 foot view, maybe 2 to 3 minutes of who you are, where you're from, where you grew up, a little bit about your family, and then kind of a real quick snapshot of, you know, the last time I saw you to where you are now. And then we'll get down into the details with some of the questions a little bit. So fire away.
Sounds good. Well, so yeah, from Townville, Pennsylvania, right? I went and I got my plastics engineering degree at Penn State Barron. So I spent a couple years there. Then I went to Ohio. I moved to Ohio and worked for Rubbermaid. So little Worcester, Ohio over there. Spent 2 years there. And then I got the job at Nike. So I applied online like any old Joe and managed to get a job at Nike. And I traveled across the country to Oregon. And I lived there for 15 years. I was at Nike for 13 of those years. And then I took this job for this car company called Tesla. And I actually fly commuted to Reno. I don't recommend anything of that situation. but I did that for 6 months. Like I, long story, but 6 months. And then I started a sneaker YouTube channel. So still out in Oregon at this time. And then this mouse and keyboard company called Logitech reached out to me and I fell in love with those guys. And so we moved to California. So I spent 3 years in California during the pandemic outside San Francisco.
Wow.
And then we, post-pandemic, we moved back to Pittsburgh. So, and I'm still at Logitech. And I work remote. I have teams all over the world now. And then about, we spent 2 years in Pittsburgh and then we just moved to Boston a year ago for my husband's job. So wow. Now I'm in, yeah, Boston, Massachusetts. So that's the last.
You've been going all over the country.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, I cannot wait to ask you about some of those places, but just your journey, your ventures, because I mean, you have such a great story. I'm a huge sneakerhead myself, so I can't wait to get some insight from you, kind of behind the scenes type of stuff. But, you know, as these episodes go, it's kind of a mutual interview. I try to get through the boring stuff first where you ask me questions, and then we get into the more interesting stuff where I get to ask you questions. Because our guests, let's be quite frank, they're probably sick of hearing me answer questions, and they really want to hear more from our guests because they're fresh, they're new, they're something that they haven't heard of or yeah. from for a long time. So three business questions first, then three personal, and then we'll kind of flip the script here and turn the tables, and then I'll ask you questions. And I tell all, you know, the guests too, that you have the ability to veto one question, but I think we're on episode 46 or 47. You would be the first person to ever veto a question. So no pressure,
ooh,
Tiffany.
Okay, I'm going to write that veto down. Okay.
All right, so go ahead, fire away.
All right, so my first question for you is, I mean, like cadavers, like the first time you like were sawing into cadavers to do what you do and learn what you're learning today. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was in med school. Yeah. We had an anatomy physiology lab and we had four students per cadaver and we would go through it very systematically. Like our professors would tell us, okay, we're going to do head and neck this next 2 weeks. And then we're going to do, you know, the shoulder, and then we're going to go into the cardiovascular. It was just very structured, but yeah, it's different, right? When we had shadowed a little bit and I had seen in undergrad some live surgeries, but when you're getting in there and you're in this cold, quite smelly room that's filled with, you know, formaldehyde and different odors that you're not used to, you learn to kind of like suppress your emotions, your feelings, which I think is, it's kind of like medical school, which is kind of like the military where there's a lot of that, like suppress. You're not supposed to feel, you're just supposed to do. And, but to try to make a little bit light of it, we had, you know, we would name our cadavers. We didn't know anything about their story other than, you know, it was a male or female and we would know their cause of death. And that was really, and their age of death. But ours was an African-American female and she had purple nail polish. So we named her Violet and you know, it was just, it was absolutely one of my most favorite courses, classes. I always really loved anatomy. I always loved physiology. That's really what drew me to medicine, was just like the body, right? Yeah. I wasn't much of a chemistry guy. I didn't really like pharmacology. I was just fascinated with the human body and just how things worked.
Yeah. Okay. Second question. So like, does it qualify if it's like a knee specific question as a business question?
Yeah.
Okay. So
there's
like,
really not that many rules. You can do whatever you want, Tiffany.
Okay. All right. From my own experience, I've had knee pain and I had issues, right? I was a jumper. I jumped a lot, right? Playing volleyball and stuff. And everyone always told me, you're going to blow out your knees, right? Your knees are going to be terrible when you're older. Well, here we are. But I started to learn about run walking. So run, walk, run to like reduce the stress on the knee and things like that. I was curious of what you thought of like using methods like that to reduce the amount of pain versus like going in and getting the full medical route and like maybe having a knee replacement.
Yeah. So I don't know a lot about that run, walk, run type of program or protocol.
Yeah.
I'm all about movement though. And quite frankly, I mean, even though I'm a surgeon, like I love to operate, but I'm not going to recommend it for everybody. I mean, you kind of have to be at the end of your rope. You have to be pretty miserable. You have to have tried all these things, conservative things, whether it's medications, whether it's physical therapy, whether it's attempts at weight loss, you know, injection therapy. But yeah, there's very few physical activities that I would ever say I wouldn't recommend. The one that I really hate, and this is really like after knee replacement, the only restriction I have, literally, I mean only, is the leg extension machine and the leg curl machine. And the reason being is, I mean, from an engineering perspective, this may make sense to you, but I mean, you have a hanging leg.
Yeah.
You've got a bar or a weight across your ankle and you're kicking out against it, as opposed to like a leg press or a squat where the forces are transmitted through your foot up through the tibia. Like this is all going basically through your patellar tendon and your quad tendon. And it just places a tremendous amount of stress on those two soft tissue structures as well as the patella. And I've just seen devastating complications after knee replacement where people can rupture their patellar tendon or quad tendon. And it's devastating if that happens and you don't have a knee replacement, but I can tell you it's 10 times worse if you already have a knee replacement. So any other activities though, run, walk, run, cycling, swimming, just running, just walking, stair climbing, weight training, I think are great because, you know, if we're stressing the joints and we're stressing the bones and the ligaments and the tendons, they're going to be mechanically stronger. But certainly if you're having, we know that you have arthritis in your knee or your hip, I wouldn't recommend something that's going to exacerbate that, right?
Yeah.
It's not that it's going to make it to the point where I can't fix it, but like, it's like hitting your head against the wall. At a certain point, if it hurts, it doesn't make much sense to do it.
Yeah. Okay.
What is run, walk, run, by the way?
So it's like, there's a guy called Jeff Galloway and he does it. He does a lot of planning for like the Disney marathons and things. That's how I found it. But, basically it's like you run for 40 seconds, you walk for 20, or you run for 90 seconds, you walk for 20 or 30, but basically you follow that cadence. So I did a whole marathon with it. And it was actually the only training way that I could get my knee to not bother me to actually get through the whole training and the marathon. And so I did a 90-20, 90 seconds of running, 20 seconds of walking, but just that 20 seconds of walking in between, like kind of stretched out the muscles and relieved to where I would have no knee pain at all.
Wow.
So I kind of fell in love with it. So I was curious of if you'd heard of it and what you thought of it. But
no, but I'm going to have to do a little bit more research now. That's awesome. Yeah. Because I do have a lot of patients, again, even after surgery, they'll say, can I run? I say, you can do whatever you want to do as long as it doesn't hurt and as long as you can tolerate it. But, you know, I think running a marathon after a joint replacement puts a pretty big stress. And I don't know of any patients personally that I've done surgery on where they've done that. I mean, they'll go out and they'll run 2 or 3 miles at a pop, yeah. And they do fine with that. But to do a full marathon, that's pretty incredible. I've done, yeah. I think, 5 or 6 half marathons. This body was not meant to run a full marathon. It just, maybe I need to run, walk, run.
Yeah, you should try it. It's funny because at first it's hard to get your brain into it because you like keep stopping. You get momentum and then you stop. But once you get into a flow with it, it's actually really nice.
Were there any other people during, what marathon did you do?
Napa Valley.
Okay. And yeah. Were there any other people doing that while you were doing it? Or?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Lots. I mean, there's whole bigger groups of people that do it for a variety of marathons. Almost every marathon has people that are doing the run, walk, run cadence. Some of the groups go together. I didn't. I went on my own, which maybe good, maybe bad. I've still finished, but yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Interesting, yeah. Now, when you're doing the run portion, are you like sprinting or is it just like you're comfortable, whatever your pace is?
You get a little used to kind of the faster pace than you're normally would run. Like if you're going to run a full mile or something like that. So, but you walk faster too. So, and you can tell once you kind of get used to it, your body sort of gets used to the duration. You don't even need a timer. I didn't, at least. And so you run, and if you're feeling good, you might run faster and walk faster. Or if you're not like in the course of a marathon, you have a lot of sections where you're not feeling so good, you might right. walk slower. So, it's really flexible.
And just, I'm really curious about this. Have they looked at like the times that people would, if they ran a marathon without walking versus the run, walk, run, were they similar since you're running faster and walking faster?
Yeah. So you can set it up so that it is. So you can set it up to be kind of whatever you want. So there are people that are running 7 minute miles, run, walk, run.
Wow.
I think I haven't seen much faster than that, but of course I don't keep that much track of it anymore, but you know, you can, so if I was just going to go out and run 3 miles, I'd probably target, you know, a 10 or 11 minute mile pace, but run, sure. walk, I'm probably going to do a 9:30 or something.
So you're actually faster that way.
Hmm?
Hmm. You're faster that way with run, yeah. walk, run. Interesting. Yeah.
Absolutely. Cause your heart rate and everything can get a chance to catch up a little bit in that 20 second. It seems small, but actually 20 seconds feels long. yeah. 10 seconds is too short, but 20 is a little too long, but 15, the math on 15 is a nightmare.
yeah. Right. No, it makes sense. Yeah. Good stuff. What else?
So my third kind of, I think it's business really, but like the idea of augmentation, right? So like at what point are joints, like what you can put in someone's body worth or going to become a point of where like, you know, mine are kind of, I mean, I don't want to go as far as like buying it on Amazon, but like, hey, you know, I could use a new joint. Like, let me get this new one put in my body. Like, do you see that happening in our lifetimes?
You mean like more customized or?
More of it being a consumer's choice, if you will. Like, I've got this knee that bugs me. It's going to be a lot of work, but it's not ready for replacement. If I could just order one on Amazon and have a knee replaced, I mean, I'd
Who's doing the surgery? The surgeon? Is a surgeon doing the surgery? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think anything's possible. Like we've seen over the past decade, you know, robotic knee and hip replacement is becoming much more common. I'm actually filming a podcast with a robotic total knee surgeon. Myself, I do what's called kinematic alignment. And then we have another guy that's more kind of old school, traditional mechanical alignment with patient-specific instrumentation where they take an MRI of the knee or CAT scan. They build a custom mold to place once you open the knee up on the bone to guide the cuts. Whereas I'm doing it all with manual instrumentation. So it's kind of old school, but the technique I use, kinematic alignment, is measured resection. So we're taking very precise resections within a half a millimeter and putting the joint back in, like our joint line obliquity, the angle at which it goes in is the exact same as the patient's anatomy versus robotics, which is the surgeon's still doing the surgery, but the robot is guiding it, and it will not allow the surgeon to cut the bone outside of a predefined window, right? Plus or minus 5 millimeters or whatever it may be. Custom implants are becoming more common. We've kind of seen them come and go, and now they're kind of coming back again. The concept of like going on Amazon and just ordering a knee is interesting. I don't know if we'll be there maybe in our lifetime, definitely not in my career. I don't think so. But you know, there's also like biologic stuff too, that we're using metal and plastic right now. I do think one of the next things, probably in the next 5 to 10 years, will be instead of metal and plastic, or alternatives to metal and plastic, are kind of bone substitute materials, yeah, where it has like 3D, like it resembles bone and cancellous bone, much like a piece of coral wood or a sponge.
Oh, interesting.
And I think that the biological fixation, as opposed to relying on like bone cement to kind of hold the implants in place, is very, very promising with these materials. So I do think that it's going to evolve tremendously over the next decade or so. And in terms of the Amazon knee, though, I'm not sure if in my career we'll see that, but you never know.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
So personal stuff?
Personal stuff. Well, why did you come back to Meadville?
Yeah. So I did undergrad in Erie. I did med school in Erie. Then I went to Metro Detroit. I did my residency there. Met my wife there my first year. So my internship year, it was a 5-year residency. And then we moved to Columbus for a year. I did a 1-year adult reconstruction hip knee fellowship there. That was 2010. That's when we had our first son, Anthony. He was born in February, so it was kind of halfway through the fellowship year. And, you know, that's right when you start thinking about, like, where am I going to practice, right? So for me and my wife, family was so critically important, being close, especially with a young son that was just born. Like, in 6 months, where are we going to live? We want to be near at least a set of grandparents. So it was either Northwest Pennsylvania for my family or Metro Detroit for her family. You know my family. I have 3 older sisters. They all have kids. Allison has 2. Shannon has 3. Kristen has 5. And then we have 3 boys. So
yeah,
at the time, we only had 1, but it seemed a bit selfish to move where my grandparents or my parents were already spoiled with grandchildren versus my wife Karen's parents not having any grandchildren. And Karen does have a sister, but her sister has some special needs, so she's not going to have any children. So we did interview in Erie and we did interview in Metro Detroit. And like any big decision, I had a legal pad, my wife had a legal pad, pros, cons.
Yeah.
And the practice was better in Michigan. The opportunity at that time was better in Michigan versus Erie. So we made that decision. And then 5 years later, we were given an opportunity. We were not Marco Island, Amelia Island, Florida, at an orthopedic conference. And orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Philip Frendak from Meadville, had said, and I just became a partner in my practice in Michigan. He was like, "Do you want a job?" And I'm like, "Yeah, no." At that point, my wife was pregnant with our last son, Lucas. He was going to be our 3rd boy, and she was like 8 months pregnant. So this was our last trip, last kid. And I just became partner. We're not moving anywhere. We're in Michigan. We set our roots there. And then Karen and I were like on the beach walking, and she was the one. She was like, "Ryan, I think you should really explore this a little bit more." And I was like, "This must be the pregnancy hormones talking, because like we're in Michigan, we're close to your family." And she was like, "This is everything you've ever like talked about, right? Like, it's a high volume practice. You'd be able to kind of do your own thing." And not that I'm afraid of competition whatsoever. I actually embrace it. But Metro Detroit, just like many big cities, you're a small fish in a big pond, right? There yeah. are tons of orthopedic surgeons versus Meadville, Pennsylvania. I would be coming back, replacing a very high volume orthopedic total joint surgeon, and it would kind of be my practice and be able to just, you know, not have to necessarily worry about competition, but like you're set up for success from a volume standpoint. So we did the same thing. We had our legal pad, pros, cons. And at the end of, you know, when we left Florida, came back to Michigan, my wife did a 180, and she's like, "We're absolutely not moving to Pennsylvania. There's no chance in hell." And I was like, "What? You just built this up for me?" And I was like, "I really want to do it now." And so over about 3 or 4 weeks, we deliberated. You know, we got closer to her delivering Luca, our youngest, and we made the decision probably a week or so before he was born that it made the most sense for our family. And all of our boys were very young at that point, so they weren't really like in a school system with developed friends and networks and things like that. So it was like, it's now or never. Yeah. And we're just thinking, if it doesn't work, we can always move back or whatever. So we made that move. The one concession, which I had no problem with, was that my wife, she's a city girl, right? Grew up in Metro Detroit. I'm a country boy, but I lived in Detroit for 10 years at that point and in Columbus for a year. So I was very comfortable in a Metro environment, but she was not able to like live in Townville or even Meadville. So we decided to live in Erie, which, I mean, I understand Erie's not that big, but it's much bigger than Townville. And there's just more opportunities for the boys and schools and things like that. So we moved to Erie. As much as Karen always says, like, who in their right mind would ever move to Erie, Pennsylvania? She actually really, really likes the people. The town is easy. And she's fallen in love. She has more friends than I have in Erie. Like, she has this group of ladies, a couple groups of ladies that she'll go out for lunch and do some mini vacations with. So yeah, it was 2015, so 10 years now when we made that decision.
Wow. I remember seeing you go back and I was like, oh, that's so good. I love it.
Yeah.
You know, I love it bringing back. It was actually part of my inspiration when I moved back to Pittsburgh.
Actually. Oh, really?
Yeah. I always had this kind of thought that I would open a footwear factory in Pennsylvania somewhere. Like a design and footwear factory. Anyways, long story, but...
I cannot wait to start asking you some questions, especially the footwear stuff.
Yeah.
So what else personal-wise?
Personal-wise. Well, so I guess what's... when you're 70, 80, retired, when you look back on your life, what is going to be like the thing that you brag about to all the people that you're hanging out with?
Honestly, it's probably going to be more family stuff. Like, it's going to be about just the life that Karen and I were able to create with and for our three boys and hopefully many grandchildren at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I absolutely love what I do for a profession. I think like some people, they have jobs, they have work, but like for me, it is my passion. But it really wouldn't mean anything if I didn't have my family there to support it. But from a career perspective, it would certainly be, I think of myself when I think of like physicians, there's academic physicians, right? That, you know, I owe so much to for the time, energy, effort that they took to teach myself and 10, 20, 30, maybe 100 other residents or fellows over the years. I have trained two fellows and I don't think I'll ever train another fellow. It's just not, I don't enjoy it as much as I enjoy patients. Like to me, I'm a patient first physician. And I know that sounds kind of cliche, but I truly mean that. Like,
yeah.
When I like started this podcast, like part of it was to celebrate local people that have been successful, but it was also to give my patients an opportunity to kind of like see a little bit behind the scenes that like I'm a human being. Yes, like I'm a very focused surgeon, physician, but I do laugh. I do joke. I do have hobbies. I do have interests outside of medicine. And, you know, I really love educating, like, my whole family. They're all teachers. Like, my dad was a teacher. My three sisters are teachers. My wife, Karen's a teacher. My aunts were all teachers. So I really enjoy educating patients. And I think that would be my professional legacy, was just how much time and effort and energy I put into educating patients and creating, like, the ultimate. This is, like, my main goal professionally, is the ultimate orthopedic journey or experience. So no one is looking forward to getting their hip or knee replacement. They're looking forward to hopefully being relatively pain-free and being able to do things that they couldn't do for many years or decades. But they are actually generally looking forward to the actual surgery. Whereas I look at, like, this opportunity as, like, Disney World. So everything that I'm doing from a patient perspective, I'm trying to make it as pleasant as possible, even if it is an unpleasant experience, right?
Yeah.
So when you walk, no one likes to go to the dentist. I went to the dentist today and it was just like, ugh. But no one likes to go to the doctor either. I want to make it so people, maybe they don't look forward to it, but when they get there, they're like, wow, this is actually really nice. Like, the environment is soothing. Like, I don't want it to feel like any other doctor or doctor's office that you've been to. And the same thing with surgery, right? Like, it's anxiety provoking. It's scary. It's nerve wracking. If I can take all of those emotions down and let those people know, like, just how much I care for them and how myself and our team are going to get them from point A to point B safely, comfortably, and hopefully when they look back, they're going to be like, that was an amazing journey. Like, I don't know how you did it or how we did it together, but it worked. And there's one book I reference quite often. I don't know if you've ever read the book Unreasonable Hospitality by Will Gadara, but it's an unbelievable book. I read it probably 2 or 3 years ago, and it really changed kind of my outlook on, like, owning a business and just the product that I deliver on a day-to-day basis, where, like, I try to go above and beyond to, like, make this experience just, like, once in a lifetime for patients.
That's amazing. I mean, that's awesome. It's such a, I like you, like, really value the energy and the experience with other people and think it's just right up there. So it's really beautiful that that is what you're trying to do and doing. And I mean, I think it's just perfect. Like, if you're looking back on that as your professional, like, what you did and how you changed it and what you cared about, that's amazing. You impacted so many people so positively. Like, yeah, well, thank it's great. You. It's really
great. That's the goal.
I knew you were going to be a rock star when we were running in New Richmond at those races and eating those pie contests. Do you remember these?
I don't.
At the ball field, the Richmond picnics?
No, I remember the picnics, but what are you referring to?
There was
to?
A pie eating contest and a sprinting really? Contest. Do you remember these?
How did I do?
I think I was faster than you, but I think you beat me in the pie eating contest. I actually think you beat, I was second in the pie eating contest 1 year, and I think you were the one that beat me, but I would think you'd remember that. I don't know.
I'll tell you one thing I do remember, and I don't know if you were on this team or not. Your brother definitely was on my team, Billy. Jonathan Tatalovic.
Fish oil.
Yes, you remember that?
Of course I was on the team.
You were on that team too. Oh, so I can't even tell you. Well, I'm going to tell the story anyways, just for the rest of the people in here. So, you know, we have this little field, Richmond Township, and we got done playing the game. I remember the dugout. I remember he went out behind the dugout and he dug this little hole and he had this bag that had, like, fish oil in it, and he buried it back there. And we're like, what is he doing? And Jonathan was always a prankster.
Yeah.
And then afterwards we're going through the line to, like, hey, good game, good game, good game. Well, he ended up putting it in his hand between his fingers and he went and slapped this kid's hand, popped the bag, and the fish oil went all over the kid. And oh my gosh, it was just, it was hilarious. It stunk horribly. But do you remember any other details from that? Or
I just remember seeing him with it, getting it out. And then I remember him getting in a lot of trouble afterwards.
Yeah. Who was our coach?
I think it was Joey Smock's dad.
Was it Ken?
I think so.
Yeah. That'd be a good guess. I think that's a safe guess.
Yeah. Man, Richmond. And then I had to bring up, like, do you remember? I think it was my mom that was supposed to pick us up, and there was like a lightning storm from the ball field, and we're like hiding in the trees next to the ball field in this like lightning storm. Do you remember this?
I remember hiding in the forest there, but there was somebody, I don't even want to mention his name, who was like bullying us. And there may have been like a thunderstorm too. That just makes it even more dramatic. But like, cause my aunt lived right there.
Yeah.
Aunt Rosalind and Uncle Don lived that.
Yeah.
Right next to there. But I do remember like being in the woods there. Yeah.
I don't remember being bullied, but it's possible. I mean, I was used to it at that point, being the only girl on all these baseball.
You reminded me a lot of Kristen, my sister Kristen, because she was like that too. She was kind of like, you know, very athletic and a tomboy. And she was like, for her age, she was like the only girl on the team, and she was better than most of the boys too.
Yeah. Yeah. And Tony was there. Tony Foote. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So anyway.
Small world.
Took us back there.
Is that all your personal questions?
I think so.
You want to spin the table?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so I'm going to throw all the rules out the window because I'm going to ask more than three questions, business and personal. But all right, so after Rubbermaid, like, was this 2006, 2007-ish, you interviewed
for? 2003.
Is that when you went to Nike?
2004.
Okay. So you said you applied, like, online. And how did that process work? Like, was Phil Knight still the guy? Was he like?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you online interview or?
Yeah. So actually, I can't remember if Phil Knight was still the guy. He was still there, but Mark Parker might have been the CEO then. I can't remember. So at Rubbermaid, they had been doing, so I was part of this team that was trying to save money at Rubbermaid. And because it was cheaper to build all your stuff overseas at the time, right? And so they were having layoff after layoff. And I was like, okay, I'm over this. Like, I'm not laid off yet, but all of my friends are. Like, all these people I know have been laid off. This sucks. And I was like, what if I could go work anywhere? And my target was Burton snowboards, because you could bring your dog to work. And I don't even think I had a dog at the time.
You just sounded cool, though, right?
But it was like, okay, you can bring your dog to work. That's amazing. And I was learning to snowboard on the ice in Ohio. I wouldn't call it a hill, but it was on ice. And I was like, well, I'd go to Oakley or I'd go to Nike. So I looked them all up online and they had jobs. And so I applied to all three, Burton, Oakley, and Nike, and they all called me back. And I was like, I must have put something wrong in the application. And so I did phone interviews with all three. And then I didn't hear from, I think I did two or three phone interviews on the Nike one. And then I didn't hear back for like 3 or 4 months. And so I was like, so disappointed. I actually accepted another job at a place in North Carolina. And it was right after I accepted it that Nike called, and they're like, we want to bring you out to interview. And I was like, oh, okay. You're kidding. Right. And so they flew me out to Oregon, and I brought my snowboard with me. I stayed a weekend, and I hitchhiked and snowboarded on Mount Hood while I was there, because I thought I'd never get a chance to go back, right? That's a whole story. But yeah, I hitchhiked with a screwdriver in my pocket, thinking that would save me if I needed it. And I interviewed, and then this was in like a January timeframe. Then it was crickets. I didn't hear anything from them for like 3 months.
So another 3 months?
Yep. Yep. Wow. Yeah. So like the first contact was in October. Then I went out in January. And then in April, they called me up and said, here's the job. Do you want it? And I was like, and they're like, you got to get out here in 2 weeks. And I was like, oh my God. So I called the other place and I said, I'm sorry, but Nike offered me a job. And the guy goes, oh, I would take that. I'm going to. And so I accepted the offer and I drove out to Oregon. I did have a dog at the time. I drove out to Oregon, and that was that.
So what is this city that Nike's headquarters is in?
So it's called Beaverton, Oregon, but okay. It's south of Portland, Oregon.
How close to Bend, Oregon is it?
It's still about 2.5-3 hours north of Bend.
Okay. I spent about 6 to 8 weeks in Bend.
Oh, yeah?
I did a research project during my residency out there looking at computer navigation for total knee replacements, but it was a cool little town.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
The Schutz Brewery.
Yeah, a lot of breweries out there in Oregon. Different world. Yeah. Well, not anymore. Now there's breweries everywhere.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, and you're in the city where I think the microbreweries really started with, like, Sam Adams.
Yeah.
Like, they're the one that really, I think, kind of kicked that microbrewery culture off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, all right, let's get into the Nike conversation because, I mean, this is just so fascinating to me. So you were there for, like, 13 years?
Yeah, 13 years.
Okay. What was it like for that 13 years? Like, what was your first role and how did you progress through the ranks during that 13 years?
So when I started, I was a product development engineer. So that means basically I was doing 3D modeling at their IHM facility. So Nike Air, it was the place where they make Nike Air. So I was designing and basically making 3D models of Nike airbags that go in your shoes to create the cushioning. And so I did two different versions, one for the LeBron shoe at the time, and then the Air Max Moto was a running shoe. And I did a heel airbag, big airbag, and I got patents on both of those, actually. And so I did that for about 2 years, and it felt very familiar. It was almost just like what I did in school, right? It was 3D modeling, injection molding, like everything I learned in plastics engineering at Behrend, I was just using it immediately. So it was fun, but I was at IHM, which is their in-house manufacturing. It wasn't Nike core. Like, it wasn't the main campus of Nike. It was like the little stepsister, if you will. And so everybody envied and wanted to be on Nike's campus. And so they had this innovation kitchen where they did all their big innovation, and they posted a job. And so I applied for it. And
6 months later, you heard back.
No, it was much faster this time. But all my colleagues had also applied for it, and they were more senior than me. And they were like, and when they heard I applied it, they're like, you're never going to get that job. And I'm like, I know, but so what? Like, who cares? Well, the hiring manager met with me, and he's like, hey, I want to let you know what this interview is going to be about. We love your resume. We love you on paper. We'd love to get you in here. And so he basically gave me some tips on the interview. And so I interviewed and I got the job. And so I was the 28th person in that group. And when I left, I think it had morphed into so many other groups. There was more than 1,000 people in innovation when I left.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I was an innovator too. They had these cool titles called innovators. And so that meant that I was going to be innovating sports, primarily footwear products at Nike. And it was like, oh my God, it was the first 5 years for sure in that role were drinking the Kool-Aid. I mean, you're working on Nike's innovation. They're at the peak of the prime. You know, we've got all these athletes. It was absolutely amazing. And so I was engineering shoes. I was developing shoes. I was finding new materials, developing new materials. And that went on for the next 10 years-ish, 11 years.
Wow.
I spent 2 years.
You were in that department, in that role for the remaining tenure at Nike?
No, actually, I was there. I was in that role for, I think, 1 year. And there was, of course, every kitchen has a pantry. And so there was a small special projects group called the pantry. And that's where Tinker Hatfield was. And he was like the big sneaker designer. And so I had started to work with them a little bit on projects. And at the time he had, I met him and he said, hey, do you think you could build this Back to the Future shoe? And he like showed me this petition of where the grassroots people built this petition. Remember when people used to do petitions online?
Yeah.
So they made this petition wanting Nike to make this shoe. And so he said, hey, do you think you could build this? And I'm like, you already made them in 1985. What's so hard? And I said, sure. You know, I didn't say sure at the time. I went back to my boss, who at the time was Bruce Kilgore. So another iconic Nike designer. He's like, you never say no to Tinker. So you're doing it. Okay. So I took on this project, and after, six months or so, they asked me to join his group. So the pantry. And so I spent the next 10 to 11 years in his special projects pantry group, which then grew to be much bigger than it was. So I was like the fifth person in that group, I think. But it was all designers. And then there was me doing development and engineering. That's where I spent the next 10 years. Yeah.
Is Tinker still there at Nike?
He is.
Yeah. Still. Do you stay in touch with him?
I do. We text back and forth from time to time. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so cool. So interesting. So, I mean, I'm sure most people have seen the movie Air. This was obviously before your time because it was early to mid 80s when, you know, the Air Jordan line was officially launched. But when athletes, like you mentioned LeBron and you worked on one of his shoes, do they have any input on design? Like the athletes themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. So I worked on the airbag for LeBron, I can't even remember which one it was. Actually, that's not true. It wasn't LeBron. It was a Jordan. See, my memory, like, it's been so long. It was a Jordan. And so after that, I got to work with a bunch of different athletes. So I did get to work on Michael Jordan's, the 23. I did little things on the 20, the 23. And then the 28, I got to play a bigger role and did a lot of engineering for it. And then the 29, I was like the lead developer.
Oh, wow.
And so in that process, yes, we would absolutely, use athlete insights, talk to the athlete. Usually the lead designer will lead that. And I was the developer or innovator. So you work closely with the designer, and the designer, you meet with them, you talk to them about what they're looking for, any challenges they're having, any issues they're having. And then also kind of like these designers were so interesting because they would just have like a casual conversation, and they would pull out these cues, like these inspirations, and they wouldn't say anything at the time. They would just be listening to the athletes. And then when we go back and work on it, they're like, well, they talked about this and this, and you'd see it show up in the designs. And you're like, it's kind of like this Mamba stuff with Kobe.
Yeah.
And so Eric was another designer in our group. And so he like figures that out and pulls it out. And then Tinker would do that with Michael Jordan. And so it was just, yeah. So the athletes absolutely, you know, you're talking to them about it. Then when you have prototypes, they're trying it. And I would say not even just the signature athletes, but in general, you know, as you're testing shoes, you're always testing it on athletes when you have samples to make sure it's what you were planning and engineering and designing. So, they absolutely always have a say.
I'm a visual guy, right? So would Jordan come in? Would he fly into Nike? And would you guys sit at a board table and start passing samples around and drawings around? And would he be like, no, I don't like this, I'd like this? Is that how that worked?
Yeah. And it might happen on campus if they're on campus, or you might fly to one of their games, you might fly to one of their homes. Like, it depended on what worked for the schedule of the shoe and for them, right? They're busy. So yeah.
Just incredible. Yeah.
Hip and my knee. When that dock
says, hey, soft bones, I'm just carrying on an old family tradition. I wanna know, Doc, soft bones, I'm just carrying on an old family tradition. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tell me all about it, Doc.
As a disclaimer, this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professional from any such conditions.